United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via video conference by Judge Peach and Judge Meredith. We're here today on the matter of the Secretary's motion to dismiss the appeal of Mr. Mark J. Stiles versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 20-3523. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with Secretary's counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Ronan Morris for the Secretary, and joining me is Deputy Chief Counsel Christopher W. Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Morris and Mr. Wallace. And Appellant's counsel.
Your Honors, Adam Luck with me is Amanda Ascoli for Veteran Mark J. Stiles.
Thank you, Mr. Luck and Ms. Ascoli. Each party, as you know, will have 30 minutes to present their arguments, and the Secretary will argue first today. Mr. Morris, would you like to reserve any portion of your time?
Yes, 6 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Okay, we will take care of that. And Mr. Morris, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honors, there are three critical questions that need to be asked here. First, do we have an appealable board decision? Can appellant get through the courthouse doors to bring this grievance? If so, is his grievance one that the court can hear? Does the court have jurisdiction over the specific matter he presents for review? And third, can appellant seek to invoke the court's jurisdiction over that matter? Your Honors, for the court to do anything in this case other than dismiss his appeal, all three questions must be answered in the affirmative. None of them are. And so, Your Honors, the Secretary's position in this case can generally be broken down into three points. First, there's no appealable board decision in this case, so there's no subject matter or derivative questions of law over which the court can exercise its jurisdiction. Second, an alleged failure by their board to refer any vertigo or sleep apnea claims is not a subject matter over which the court has jurisdiction. And third, Your Honors, appellant lacks standing to challenge the board's failure to refer his vertigo and sleep apnea claims. And we can approach this case in a number of ways, Your Honors, but because the last point implicates a constitutional prerequisite to judicial review in addition to a statutory one, that's where I'd like to start. Your Honors, appellant lacks standing to challenge the board's alleged failure to refer his vertigo and sleep apnea claims. That is, he asserts that the board violated regulatory section 20.904B because it failed to refer those claims, but he fails to establish that he suffered any real or concrete harm as a result of that action. Party seeking to invoke a court's jurisdiction must establish their standing here under both Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution and 38 U.S.C. 7266. Article 3 standing requires a party seeking to invoke a court's jurisdiction to have suffered an alleged harm caused by the challenged conduct that is both concrete and particularized and actual or imminent, not conjectural or hypothetical. And Section 7266A limits who may initiate appeals to this court, to persons adversely affected by a final board decision. Under the court's case law, the latter agreement requirement generally echoes the injury in fact requirement of Article 3, although the burden of proof appears to be a bit more onerous under the statute. Here, appellant seeks to maintain his appeal on the assertion that the board violated 20.904B because it failed to refer his vertigo and sleep apnea claims. But he doesn't explain what real and concrete harm he suffered as a result of that failure to refer those claims. In other words, Your Honors, the appellant alleges here a purely legal or technical violation of the regulation. But even in the context of an alleged statutory or regulatory violation, the claimant must do more than just allege a violation of that statute or regulation. They must show that they suffered a real and concrete harm as a result of that alleged violation.
So even Mr. Morris, VA first recognized that he had a claim. Let's focus on the vertigo for a minute. On the vertigo issue in 2008, it never issued a rating decision. We're in 2022 now. And don't you think that the passage of time alone, as well as the lack of a decision, he could have been receiving, you know, assuming he was entitled, could have been receiving benefits for the last 15 or so years?
Well, Your Honor,
Why is that not sufficient harm in this case? Are you saying that VA can delay this forever just by failing to recognize the claim?
To that latter point, no, Your Honor. To the initial question, though, is my answer is several fold. First, there is no allegation of delay here, nor is there any connection, you know, made or alleged between a failure to refer a claim and any delay. That's pure conjecture at this point. But perhaps more importantly, the challenged conduct here is the board's failure to refer the appellant's vertigo and sleep apnea claim. Apologies. The challenged conduct is not a delay. A delay is an entirely different injury, and it's one that's not caused or committed by the board. It's one that's caused or committed by the agency. So it's not one that could be addressed in the context of an appeal of the board's decision, nor is it one that can be redressed by ordering the board to refer any claims.
And the failure to make a decision altogether?
That also is not something that is subject to an appeal of a board's decision, but it's also, again, it's not the harm that's being alleged. It is a very different harm traceable to a very different conduct, the failure of the agency to adjudicate a claim. And if that is the case, and the appellant in this case appears to suggest that it may not be, but if that is the case, then there are other remedies appropriate, specifically a petition for the issuance of a writ, because it is the petition of the issuance of a writ that can compel the secretary to issue a decision so that an appeal can eventually be taken. But again, that's not where we are here. The appellant is seeking to appeal a board decision, and the board is not responsible for any alleged non-adjudication of any claim.
Well, in the sense that the board failed to apply 904, then some of the responsibility may lay with the board itself. Why is that not the case?
Because the board, what the appellant is seeking from the board or from the court in this case is apparently it is a remand for the court to send the matter, the question back to the board so that the board can refer it to the agency. Now, Your Honor, again, the secretary has other points here, broader points regarding the court's jurisdiction, but in the context of standing, in the context of an injury, a concrete injury, again, there's no connection here, first of all, between the failure to refer. The failure to refer is simply the failure to acknowledge, you know, or to redirect something towards the RO. But if that claim exists before the RO, which is implicit in the idea of a referral or a demand for a referral, that claim exists within the regional office, within the agency. And so that injury, any potential delay, whether it be from 2008 on the vertigo alleged vertigo claim or any other, that is inaction by the RO. And that inaction is not triggered by the failure to refer a claim. That is simply the result of the RO's alleged failure to adjudicate a claim.
Well, then what is the purpose of 20.904? I'm confused. Why would they even have this reg? It means nothing. And it certainly someone who is alleging this injury of a violation of 904, you're saying would not even ever have standing to put that forth.
I don't know that I'm making the statement as broadly as ever, but, you know, but it would appear to be the case. But to answer the question about what's the purpose of the regulation, well, again, the answer is at least twofold. And the first part of that answer, Your Honor, is that we don't really need to get there. In the standing context, there's no allegation of a concrete harm. We can assume, for the sake of argument, that the regulation does compel the board, you know, to refer a claim that's reasonably raised and unadjudicated. We can even assume that that regulation was violated here. That alone, though, is not a concrete harm sufficient to give rise to standing. Moreover, that question of what 20.904B actually requires is a merits question that goes to the merits of the appellant's current appeal. We don't get to the merits of his appeal unless there is both an appealable board decision to begin with and the court has jurisdiction over the specific grievance of whether the board's failure to refer, you know, was appropriate. So that is a derivative question, but we can assume for the purposes of standing all of that. We can assume that that regulation requires these things. I will say, however, that the regulation simply is not, the purpose of that regulation, even though it's outside the scope of this this context is not to demand a referral. It is to articulate the distinction between when claims should be remanded, when the board has that jurisdiction over a claim, and when it should not be remanded. And as its regulatory history makes clear, it simply codifies the board's longstanding practice of referring and not remanding claims over which it lacks jurisdiction. Again, it is at best, what the appellant is alleging is at best here, a mere violation of that regulation divorced from any concrete harm. And so, Your Honors—
Can I jump in there, or did you have another question?
Oh, go ahead, Judge Meredith.
So on that point, 20.904 says that the board shall refer if it becomes aware of an unadjudicated pending claim. What is VA's position as to, is there any recourse for an appellant if the board fails to comply with that shall refer language?
Well, at the very least, Your Honor, we would need there to be some concrete harm to give rise to the court's ability to review that question. We would need a case where, at the very least, we even get through the courthouse door to consider whether that's a question that even can be addressed. But assuming all those things, and even assuming for the moment that the court would have that type of jurisdiction, recourse is dependent on the injury. And so if the injury is solely a procedural violation, then there is no need for recourse. Because again, if ultimately what the appellant, if ultimately the appellant, and he doesn't allege that to be the case here, but a hypothetical appellant is aggrieved because the agency hasn't adjudicated their claim. They believe that a claim exists, but the agency hasn't adjudicated it. Well, then the first step would be to contact the agency and seek an adjudication of that claim. And if all else fails, it would be to file a writ to compel the issuance.
I could stop you there. You're saying that there isn't any recourse at the board because the appellant here, prior to the board decision on appeal, argued to the board that there were pending unadjudicated claims and asked for a referral. And then after the board issued its decision, asked for motion for reconsideration for the board to acknowledge pending unadjudicated claims. Your position is that 20.904 does not provide, there's no recourse at the board for the appellant. It's at the agency.
Yes. If there is an allegation of an unadjudicated claim that either has been unduly delayed in the adjudication or a refusal to adjudicate that claim, then yes, then the recourse begins at the agency and allow the agency to make a decision.
As to the agency, the appellant has essentially asserted that you can't seek recourse at the agency because there isn't an appropriate form to fill out, if I understand his argument. What is VA's official position on that? What is the proper procedure at the agency of original jurisdiction if you believe there's a pending unadjudicated claim, and does it require any particular form?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that the simplest solution would be to simply contact the agency, as appellants do all the time, when they have, something to provide or present to the agency. And there are many ways that they can do that. I would also suggest, Your Honor, that if there is a true discrepancy, then submitting an application for benefits. In this case, what the appellant wants is a referral, meaning a referral of a claim that the appellant acknowledges the board could not have adjudicated, meaning that it has not been adjudicated by the agency. Submitting an application, especially at this point represented by counsel, would seem to be the most prudent course of action because it gets a claim specifically in front of the agency and requires them to adjudicate it. And any downstream questions as to, if the claim is granted, as to effective date, that can all be dealt with after the agency makes its decisions. And those decisions include the scope of the claim, whether to grant the benefits, any development that's necessary, and ultimately whether, if granted, the effective date. What we're arguing here and what 20.904B, again, with the caveat that I believe, that the Secretary does believe that this goes to the merits of the appeal, which is not present, it simply requires a referral. It's a board rule that codifies a longstanding practice that is not 20.904B does not actually direct or require the regional office to take any action based on that referral. This is something, simply something that allows the board to flag an issue, flag a claim, that potentially exists in the record so that the RO is on notice of that because the board spotted it. But again, there are very many ways that a claimant themselves can, you know, can address the issue. And it would begin first by simply contacting the agency and asking the agency to take action on a claim. But again, Your Honor, we don't even get to these points. These questions, Your Honor, are derivative. They're merits questions because we don't, in this case, we don't even get through the courthouse doors. Because, in other words, a court doesn't have jurisdiction at all in this case. There's no appealable board decision. The court's jurisdiction is established and defined by statute and limited to a review of final decisions of the board. A final decision is one that ends the litigation on the merits, and as the Federal Circuit explained, you know, for purposes in this context, it's a decision by the board with respect to benefits sought that either grants or denies those benefits. There's no dispute in this case that the board did not grant, deny, or otherwise terminate any claim for benefits. It addressed two claims in its decision, increased ratings for chronic sinusitis and allergic rhinitis, and it remanded both of those claims. And case law is indisputably clear that a remand is not a final board decision for jurisdictional purposes. The board didn't address any claims for vertigo or sleep apnea, let alone issue any final decision on those claims.
Well, Mr. Morris, I believe the appellant argues that this was an implicit denial of the vertigo and sleep apnea claims under a Cogburn Deschotel type analysis.
Your Honor, first, my response to that is that first, that is would seem to be inherently contradictory of what the appellant wants, which is a referral of claims that were not adjudicated by the RO. The idea that the RO also denied those claims, but that the claims were not adjudicated by the RO are inherently contradictory. Second, the appellant's motion for reconsideration, the specific allegation that the appellant raised was the violation of 20.904B, which again assumes that no claims have been adjudicated. But, Your Honors, if that were the case, and assume that the RO implicitly denied these within the context of you know, the one of the two claims that it did address, then we still don't have a final decision because the board remanded that claim. And the question as to the scope of that claim is something that ultimately will be decided by the RO. The ultimate compensation that the appellant is permitted or is due to the appellant is something that will be addressed and we do not have a final decision on. So if that is the case, Your Honor, then we really shouldn't be here at all because it is very clear that there is no dispute because those...
Why are you asserting, Mr. Morris, that any implicit decision was a remand rather than a denial when the board did not explicitly deny the sleep apnea vertigo?
Apologies, Your Honor. If the agency implicitly denied these claims, and again, Your Honor, that does not appear to be the position that the appellant took, certainly not the one.
Certainly he's allowed to have an alternative argument. There's nothing wrong with saying, yeah, 904 applies. Oh, by the way, if you don't buy that, then there was an implicit denial here.
And if that's the case, if there was an implicit denial, then taking that argument, and as I believe, you know, as it appears, you know, to be expressed, that was an implicit denial because the vertigo, and I believe it only applies to the vertigo because the sleep apnea was, I believe, undisputably only raised in the context of an argument to the board. But as to the vertigo, assuming that it was implicitly denied by the regional office, it would have been implicitly denied by the regional office, or perhaps even explicitly denied, in the context of its adjudication of the veteran's original claims and the assignment of the disability evaluations for those claims, meaning the agency looked at those claims and it assigned the veteran a certain disability rating. And if that was true, if that did occur, we do not have a final board decision on that because the board remanded those only two original claims that were before it. So if this vertigo is a part of either one of those claims, such that the veteran was entitled to, you know, higher compensation or potentially entitled to higher compensation, then those claims are sent back and there's still no final board decision on those matters. So it's not the agent, it's irrelevant what the agency did for this purpose, because either way, we don't have a final board decision over which the court has any jurisdiction. And again, at best, what we have in this case is a, you know, decision by the board that remanded two claims whether those claims, you know, at a later date can be decided to have included or not included vertigo or sleep apnea or anything else, that's not before the court because we don't have a final decision on that from the board. And again, Your Honor, 72...
Regarding this issue of implicit decisions, could I get you to talk about the Federal Circuit's Kirkpatrick opinion, which basically rejected an appellant's argument that an implicit denial, rejected his argument that the board implicitly found jurisdiction and created a final appealable board decision through its own silence. Could you talk about Kirkpatrick?
Your Honor, to the extent, I can to a limited extent, but if I can preface that with the distinction, the overwhelming distinction that we have in this case, which is that we don't have anything that gets anyone into the court. We don't have anything that satisfies the requirements, you know, not just for the court's jurisdiction, but to initiate an appeal. Because only a person adversely affected by a final board decision can even get into the courthouse. And it's only at that next step that there's any consideration whatsoever as to the scope of the court's jurisdiction and whether that jurisdiction would or would not extend to one issue over another to include the idea of some form of implicit denial. But there's no allegation here that the board implicitly denied any claim. So even if we assume that there was a claim implicitly denied by the RO, the board did not implicitly deny any claim.
As to the actions of the board and whether the board implicitly did something that could be appealed here. In Kirkpatrick, the Federal Circuit basically said that the board's silence on a jurisdictional question could not be construed as an implicit denial that could serve as a final board decision to be appealed here. Is that comparable to what we have, the circumstances we have here? Even if the board did implicitly deny something, can that silence constitute the final board decision for purposes of our jurisdictional hook?
If the board implicitly denied jurisdiction over the vertigo and sleep apnea claims, I'm sorry, just to clarify the question, is that the question? That if the board is read to have implicitly denied jurisdiction over these claims, would that be a jurisdictional hook?
Whatever you characterize the implicit decision as, can their silence constitute a final board decision that can be appealed?
Yeah, no, Your Honor, and I apologize because I'm struggling to apply that to a scenario such as this where there is no allegation of any improper taking or refusal to take jurisdiction. The argument here is that the board failed to refer something, which again, you know, assumes and, you know, that the board had no jurisdiction and did not improperly decline that jurisdiction. What we have here, we don't have a decision on any claim, even one that by virtue of a declination of jurisdiction where the board should have taken it, you know, de facto acts as a denial of benefits. We have none of that. We have a desire to have the board refer something to the agency that wasn't adjudicated, that there is no dispute that the board had no jurisdiction. There's no allegation that the board improperly didn't adjudicate these claims. The demand for relief is for a referral, and the failure to refer a claim is not a decision on that claim for the purpose of the court's jurisdiction. It's not a grant or denial of benefits. It doesn't end the litigation of any claim, and it has no impact on the merits of that claim or the ability to pursue that claim. It also doesn't impact the jurisdictional status of the claim or derivatively this court's jurisdiction over the claim. So in other words, Your Honor, it's not an exercise of jurisdiction over a claim. It's also not a refusal to adjudicate a claim. So there's no implicit findings here, and certainly no implicit findings of jurisdiction that the appellant even disagrees with. Because again, the demand, you know, the demand would be for a referral. But even if there were, it still wouldn't be sufficient. But again, I'm having a hard time applying that to a case where the board remanded the only two claims it addressed and it didn't make And the allegation is not that it improperly declined or took jurisdiction, it's simply that it failed to take a procedural action to acknowledge its lack of jurisdiction over a claim over which it didn't have jurisdiction, couldn't have granted or couldn't have denied that claim. So again, Your Honor, I see my time is winding down.
Mr. Kay, please add 5 minutes.
We have these three discrete issues here. And the first issue, the broadest issue, is there anything to get the appellant into this courthouse? Is he a person adversely affected by a final board decision? And there is no allegation that the board, with respect to any claims decided or even not, transparently decided, that it denied any benefits or terminated any claim. What the appellant wants and what he can do is still pursue his claim at the agency.
And so, Mr. Morris, Judge Meredith, are you finished with that line of questioning?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Morris, so the secretary's position is that a veteran can file a claim, not have an explicit decision at the RO, raise in a informal hearing presentation or a brief before the board, specifically argue that, they deserve a decision, and that even notwithstanding the existence of 20.904, the board has no obligation to do anything as to that argument, and that unless there is a denial of a benefit in the subsequent decision, the appellant has no recourse with the board and has to essentially start all over at the RO. That is the secretary's position here.
I think in a manner of characterizing it, yes, Your Honor, but I don't believe that this is a, Your Honor, the court is the gatekeeper of its, is its own gatekeeper of its jurisdiction. But Congress built those gates and Congress set the rules of entry. And Congress very specifically required that that this court only has jurisdiction over final board decisions, and that only a person adversely affected by a final board decision can initiate an appeal. And so it is not the secretary's attempt to litigate, case law to his favor. This is precedential case law. This is simply the case law that exists in the statutes that Congress created. If and when the appellant is harmed, or if he believes that he is currently harmed and that harm is being caused by the agency, then the appellant has recourse. It is certainly not to appeal a board decision that did not address, let alone issue a final decision on the two claims from which his grievance derives. The appellant has that recourse. This court simply lacks any final decision to even get anything into this court, let alone, or the jurisdiction to decide this particular question of whether a referral is appropriate. I'd note, Your Honors, that even in Young, where the court did consider, a referral versus a remand, which again is a very different, because that was an assertion that the board refused to take jurisdiction. But even in that case, Your Honors, the court predicated its jurisdictional analysis on a finding that part of the very same claim that the board referred, the board also denied. And so it was based on the jurisdiction over that claim that the court even got into, its review of the, referral versus a remand. But again, there was not only an appealable decision in that case, Your Honors, but the very essence of the very claim that the board considered was one that was also denied by the board. And what the court reviewed, that jurisdictional question, was one of the board's refusal to take jurisdiction, not one of the board's non-taking of jurisdiction over an issue that it didn't have jurisdiction to take. There's nothing that the board could have done adjudicatively with respect to this claim. It had no jurisdiction. At most, it could have flagged, these claims, and that's a merits question whether they even exist, but at most it could have flagged these and sent it, and let the RO or let the agency know of it. Appellant can do the same thing. And if he believes that these claims exist and haven't been adjudicated, he can contact the region, the RO. And if the RO refuses to take action, then he can file a writ. and compel, you know, and ask the court to compel the secretary to issue a decision so that it can be appealed. So, Your Honors, again, I see my time is winding down. But again, the appellants attempting to appeal a board decision that only remanded two claims, which issued no final decision on any claim. It did not terminate any claim, you know, for benefits, let alone those for sleep apnea and vertigo.
Judge Meredith, do you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Peach, do you have questions?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Luck, you may move ahead with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Chief Judge Bartley, Judge Peach, Judge Meredith, and may it please the court. Once again, my name is Adam Luck, and I represent veteran Mark J. Stiles. As Judge Meredith alluded to earlier, in this case, Mr. Stiles argued to the board that the record reasonably raised claims for service connection of his obstructive sleep apnea and vertigo, and requested that the board refer those claims to the regional office for initial adjudication. The board remanded separate claims for increased ratings for sinusitis and allergic rhinitis, but didn't refer his reasonably raised claims. In fact, it didn't even address his arguments. So Mr. Stiles requested reconsideration of the board's decision on the sole basis that the board failed to refer his reasonably raised claims. The board acknowledged his request and denied it, again, not referring his sleep apnea and vertigo claims. So Mr. Stiles appealed to the court. The secretary moved to dismiss, and the sole basis for the secretary's motion to dismiss is that the remanded claims of sinusitis and rhinitis are not final decisions within this court's jurisdiction. And right off the bat, Mr. Stiles would like to make two things clear, is that he's not arguing that the court has jurisdiction over the remanded claims in the board's decision. And two, he's not arguing that the court has jurisdiction over the merits of his sleep apnea and vertigo claims, but rather that the court has jurisdiction to review the board's failure to refer his sleep apnea and vertigo claims. So the issue in this case is whether a board decision that expressly remands some claims but fails to refer or adjudicate or implicitly denies separate unrelated claims can confer jurisdiction to this court. And Mr. Stiles asserts that the board's refusal to refer his reasonably raised claims is a final determination that is independently reviewable by this court, regardless of the outcome of the separate unrelated claims of sinusitis and rhinitis. And the board's failure to refer in this case, is not mere oversight, but is rather a conscious decision of the board to refuse his request. And that contained implicit findings that Section 20.904B either did not apply or that the board was not obligated to refer the claims. So given the unique facts of this case, Mr. Stiles would like to walk the court through how it has jurisdiction in this case. So the starting point is the regulation itself. 20.904B is the remunerated version of what was formerly Section 19.9B, and that states that the board shall refer reasonably raised claims to the regional office. And whether to refer or remand or adjudicate on the merits, they all require express or implied jurisdictional determinations by the board. So Section 20.904B conveys jurisdiction on the board to determine if any claims have been reasonably raised by the record, and then to determine if those claims are either in appellate status or if they must be referred to the regional office for initial adjudication. So if they're in appellate status, the board has to adjudicate them. If they are not, 20.904B requires that the board refer those claims to the regional office for initial adjudication. The veteran doesn't need to take any additional action to follow up with the regional office. It's the board's affirmative duty under Section 20.904B. This court has held that it has jurisdiction to review board jurisdictional determinations. It has jurisdiction to review the board's referral or refusal to refer pursuant to its determinations made under 20.904B. And in Mr. Stiles' case, because the board did not address the merits of the sleep apnea or vertigo, it can only be concluded that it determined that Section 20.904B did not apply or that it was not obligated to refer the claims. And it is these implicit determinations that conferred jurisdiction to this court. And this conclusion is supported.
Mr. Luck, some of the cases that I think you're thinking of, even though you didn't mention them or you've done this before, don't those have distinguishing factors in that we have usually required some kind of hook? And in Young, it was the presence of other claims that were denied where the veteran was adversely affected, along with the issue that they did not address. So here, what is your hook?
Thank you, Your Honor. So in this case, and again, as stated earlier, this is a unique factual situation. But in this case, the hook is Section 20.904B because that requires affirmative action by the board. So in Miller v. Wilkie, the court noted that the board often makes implicit factual findings and determinations and can even deny whole claims without expressly stating so. And the Miller court also noted that the court has no problem reviewing those implicit factual findings and determinations, and that there should be no exception as to when implicit findings and denials should be reviewed. So what distinguishes this case and provides that hook from those other cases is that the enforceability of Section 20.904B should not be contingent on a separate, unrelated denial of a claim that has no impact on what was denied. And here, that is a specific benefit referral under Section 20.904B that Mr. Stiles was denied. And I will say, in terms of implicit denial, this court found in Ray v. Wilkie that the board decision to refer or not to refer is a factual determination. And in Miller, again, the board can make implicit factual determinations and denials. And to your point, Chief Judge Bartley, the court in those other cases has reviewed board referral determinations on multiple occasions, whether that's presidential or non-presidential decisions.
Yes, but aren't those cases all accompanied by a denial of a benefit? That is, they say, the board says, oh yeah, we don't need to refer. By the way, your claim for extra schedule at TDIU is denied, or something like that.
In many of those cases, Your Honor, the claim that was denied, say there was a right knee condition was denied, was not even the focal point of the court's decision. The focal point of the court's decision was actually the failure to refer. So, for example, one of the most direct cases on point is Beverly v. Nicholson. And in that case, the veteran submitted evidence that reasonably raised a claim to special monthly compensation, and the board didn't address the evidence. The board didn't address any reasonably raised claims, and it did deny a separate unrelated benefit. And the veteran appealed the board's silence on his reasonably raised claims, and the court held that even where there's no board decision, that it has jurisdiction over a claim if it was reasonably raised to the board. And it further stated that when the board fails to construe a veteran's pleadings to reasonably raise the issue of whether a claim were reasonably raised to the board, that the court has jurisdiction that can be appealed to the court. And it's expressly stated that the board cannot simply ignore reasonably raised claims. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? Wonderful.
Yes.
Judge Peach, please go ahead.
May I raise a question regarding a clarification? It seems that Mr. Stiles received a letter from the VA regional office back in 2008 advising him that no further action will be taken on your claim for service connection for vertigo unless and until you file a specific disability or illness associated with vertigo, parentheses, dizziness or lack of balance. because a vertigo is just a symptom and not a disability for which service-connected benefits are payable. Do you know whether Mr. Stiles submitted anything between 2008 and 2000, what was it, 13, when he received his service connection for the other two disabilities? Did he submit anything with respect to that vertigo?
He did not respond to that letter, Your Honor. And what's perplexing about that 2008 letter is its notation that vertigo is not a disability, when vertigo itself was actually, and still is, listed in the VA schedule of ratings as a disability, as a compensable disability. So that 2008 letter is a bit of an anomaly. But to your point, I don't think he directly responded to that letter, no ma'am.
Was he represented at that time, Mr. Luck, by a attorney?
No, ma'am, he was not.
Thank you.
And that so that takes care of the vertigo, as far as I can see. Look for clarification on his sleep apnea. What Mr. Stiles is saying, that it was reasonably raised because of because of medical records in the record.
With his initial claim, he submitted his in reference to service treatment records, which contain a in-service sleep study diagnosing him with sleep apnea while on active duty.
And did, just refresh my recollection, did Mr. Stiles, he wrote to the board prior to the board making a decision, and he mentioned vertigo. Did he also mention sleep apnea?
He mentioned that his breathing, his sinus and breathing conditions affected his ability to sleep. And that was contained in a notice of disagreement that was filed in 2013.
No further questions at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Stiles,
I'd like to get back to the issue of whether we have a final board decision here. As you mentioned, the board in the decision on appeal remanded two issues. And are you acknowledging the board did not say anything explicitly about vertigo or sleep apnea?
Yes, ma'am. In the board's decision, the board did not address obstructive sleep apnea or vertigo. And that is why Mr. Stiles requested reconsideration of that decision.
So the jurisdictional hook here depends on your argument that the board implicitly denied referral by saying nothing. And so I get back to what I was asking VA counsel about is the Federal Circuit's opinion in Kirkpatrick. And in Kirkpatrick, the Federal Circuit rejected the appellant's argument that by saying nothing as to a jurisdictional question, that the board had implicitly denied relief and that that was an appealable decision, and the Federal Circuit said it was not. How do you square your argument, which here seems to depend entirely on board silence as to the matter, as being the final decision that could be appealed?
I do think Kirkpatrick is distinguishable in this case, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that Kirkpatrick was written before Section 20.904B was promulgated, and even before its predecessor, 19.9 was promulgated and became effective in 2011, several years after Kirkpatrick was issued. The second reason is because that regulation created an affirmative requirement on the board to refer those reasonably raised claims. So this wasn't a silence without a regulatory requirement, without an affirmative duty on the board. And what further distinguishes this from Kirkpatrick is that Mr. Stiles raised this request for referral on more than one occasion. And in his request for reconsideration, that was the sole basis. And the board acknowledged that request and then still made the conscious decision, knowing he is requesting referral, knowing Section 20.904B required referral, and it still decided not to refer the claim.
Okay, so to that point, though, we're still relying on board silence, whether there's a regulation or not. And I'd like to get to the regulation in a minute. But the Federal Circuit in Kirkpatrick relied on its decision in Howard, where the board had explicitly talked about one claim, but did not discuss the appellant's Q motion. And the appellant tried to appeal and force a decision on the Q motion, and the Federal Circuit said, no, the board had not rendered a decision on the Q motion. Do we have a similar circumstance here where the board didn't render a decision one way or another as to referral because there's complete silence as to that question?
I think Howard is equally as distinguishable. In Howard, the Q motion addressed the issue that was remanded. And additionally, while in Howard, the appellant referred to his Q claim, we know that raising a request for revision of a rating decision on the basis of Q is not a separate claim. 20.904B requires, applies to reasonably raised claims, and a Q motion is not a claim. So I understand Howard to say you are raising an issue within the context of an item that was remanded, and that issue was not addressed by the board. It was not addressing a separate claim that was raised by the record or directly to the board that the board failed to address or refer.
And Howard, you're saying that the board addressed the Q motion? I think the Federal Circuit's language says that they had not rendered a decision on that particular issue and that we lack jurisdiction to consider it.
That's correct.
We have complete silence on the issue, but I'll turn now to the regulation that you've talked about. You essentially have argued that 20.904 conveyed some amount of jurisdiction on the board. And is there a statute that provides the board with some amount of jurisdiction over claims that have not yet been adjudicated by the RO? And if not, how could a regulation convey jurisdiction onto the board?
The interesting thing about 20.904B is that it was promulgated not interpreting a statute, but under the secretary's own ability to issue regulations to govern the procedures off of which it operates. And 20.904B, to the context that it creates that board jurisdictional determination, is not — what I meant by that is not that it creates jurisdiction on the board to adjudicate the merits of those claims, but to identify reasonably raised claims. And it's that obligation of the board when reviewing a claim that if it discovers a claim that has been reasonably raised, that it must take affirmative action. And in promulgating 19.9B, the predecessor to 20.904B, the VA specifically said that the purpose of requiring the board to do that is so that these claims that were reasonably raised by the record will not be overlooked. It was to assist the veteran that the board, as an entity of the VA, of the agency, all work together to make sure the veteran's claims are being addressed.
So the VA in promulgating the regulation also said that the point of the regulation was so that the board could notify the RO to flag the claim for the RO that it remained unadjudicated, as you said, so it wouldn't go overlooked. How does flagging something, a duty to flag this issue for a regional office, constitute an exercise of jurisdiction? And I think I take your prior answer to mean that there is no statutory authority for the board to exercise jurisdiction in any manner over claims that have not yet been adjudicated by an RO.
There is no statute that mandates that, and again, the jurisdiction is to refer. It has the jurisdiction, the authority, the power to refer those claims to the regional office. And to steal the secretary's language there regarding notice, the purpose of board's referral, like the secretary says, to put the regional office on notice that there are pending claims that need action. That is the same thing as a form. When a veteran files a form, an informal claim, or uses one of the standardized forms, it's placing the VA on notice that there is a claim that is now pending or a request for a benefit that is now pending that needs action. And 20.904B was to assist the veteran in allowing the board to refer those claims to the regional office so that it can take action on those claims.
So if counsel for the secretary is correct, and there's essentially no mechanism for enforcing 20.904 at the board, do you acknowledge the process that VA laid out of what you should do if there may be a pending unadjudicated claim? And has the appellant here gone to the RO and asked for a decision on any of these pending claims since the 2019 board decision?
Well, prior to the board decision, the veteran was not represented by counsel, and it was only immediately after he was represented by counsel that this was brought up to the board's attention. And invoking 20.904B, the language itself doesn't say what the board should do, it says what the board must do. And it is that mandatory language that also carries with it that the veteran does not need to take additional action at the regional office. The veteran doesn't need to follow up because it's the board's responsibility to refer those claims.
So, and, is that a no?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Since the 2019 board decision, has the appellant taken any steps to try to seek a final decision from the RO?
We requested referral from the board, Your Honor. And following the VA's procedures, that regional office, that is a procedural mechanism at which to obtain a decision from the regional office. That
so in our DiCarlo opinion, which I believe the chief cited in her original decision, it laid out what the court deemed as the appropriate procedure in the face of a pending adjudicated claim at the RO, and said that the appropriate procedure was to seek issuance of a final RO decision. Are you suggesting that that is not a valid process?
DiCarlo was decided prior to the promulgation of 19.9 and 20.904B. And so at that time, when there was no mandatory requirement for the board to refer these reasonably raised claims, that was the only option, was to seek a decision to follow up with an entity at the regional office. But now that we have 20.904B, raising the reasonably raised claims, putting the board on notice that there are pending claims, triggers 20.904B for the board to take that mandatory action to refer those claims. And this court has held that the board is part of the agency, so you are raising it to the agency, and the agency is working together. The board and the regional office are not separate entities, but one collective that's assisting in a pro-claimant system. So the DiCarlo, it just didn't have the regulatory requirement at the time that it was decided.
Even prior to the promulgation of 20.904 and its predecessor, there was case law, though, that I believe VA said it was following when it created that regulation. It was promulgating the regulation pursuant to what the court had already approved as a process. So you're suggesting that something changed in there as to what the board was expected to do as to referrals?
The board did have a longstanding history of referring those reasonably raised claims, which the way Mr. Stiles sees it is just more emphasis on and confusion as to why it would not refer his claims in this scenario. If the board has been doing it for so long and there's a regulation that requires the board to do it, it just refused here. But to your question, the court noted what the board should do, what the board has long done, but there wasn't that requirement that the board must do. And 20.904B required the board shall refer these reasonably raised claims.
Let me ask you one final question. If we were to accept your premise that the board's complete silence on this issue could be a final decision that could give us a jurisdictional hook, what would happen if the appellant had not appealed that decision? Could an unappealed silent decision later on have a preclusive effect as a final unappealed board decision?
I believe implicit denials are implicit denials. They are just as actionable and as binding as explicit denials and factual findings. And just as the Federal Circuit noted that claims can be implicitly denied through silence, that is just as binding on the veteran as the board's decision. So if the board implicitly denies a claim and it goes unappealed and later tries to raise it again at the board or raise it again at the regional office, and no one takes action because it determined that the board's silence was the implicit denial, he's going to be met with, well, you should have appealed.
One follow-up on that. Did the appellant here receive any type of notice of appellate rights as to vertigo or sleep apnea?
No, ma'am. He did not. He had the normal appellate rights that accompanied his notice of disagreement in 2013.
Nothing in the board decision purported to be a final decision as to sleep apnea or vertigo.
Can you repeat that, Your Honor?
There's nothing in the board decision itself or if its notice of appellate rights purported to be making a final decision as to vertigo or sleep apnea.
Well, often with implicit factual findings, they're implicit because they don't specifically address the issue. But looking beyond the four corners of just the board's decision, we also have to look at the request for reconsideration and the board's ruling on that request for reconsideration. There are more facts than what are just contained in that board's decision because of the explicit request for reconsideration on the basis that the board failed to refer those reasonably raised claims. And again, the board was aware of these arguments. The arguments were present before the board's decision. They were present before or at the time that he requested reconsideration. The board acknowledged that request and then denied that request on the basis that it remanded separate unrelated claims.
And if I may interrupt here, Judge Merritt, when the veteran, I don't think you attached the board chairman's decision about on your motion for recon. Was there a notice of appellate rights attached there too? Do you recall?
It was just the ruling on the motion, Your Honor.
Okay, just the letter.
Yes, ma'am.
That's fine. Okay. Okay, but doesn't our Tyrus decision require for a final board decision that there be not only, you know, a denial of a benefit, let's say, or a decision on a benefit, but also a notice of appellate rights?
Well, the notice of appellate rights, Your Honor, came with the board's original decision. And then on the request for reconsideration.
What date of decision are you talking about there? You said the board's original decision.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was referring to the decision that Mr. Stiles requested reconsideration of. It was the 2019 decision, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'm getting confused. I thought you just told Judge Meredith that there was no notice of appellate rights as to that decision because it remanded two issues and supposedly did nothing else.
I think I might have been confused as to the question.
So there was a notice of appellate rights?
I might have got confused with Judge Meredith's inquiry regarding the original rating decision that denied the sinusitis and rhinitis claims. My apologies about that. Regarding the board's remand, there was not a notice of appellate rights, Your Honor.
Okay. And just to confirm, and as to the motion for recon, the board motion for recon that you filed, there was no notice of appellate rights with that. That was just the letter.
That was just the letter. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Let's add 5 minutes. Go ahead, Judge Peach.
Yes. With respect to 904B, your proposition is that confers on the board the jurisdiction. Why wouldn't we consider that rule a kind of a claims processing rules to facilitate the processing, an orderly processing of a claim?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that one, it does confer that limited jurisdiction to review the record and identify any reasonably raised claims, and then to determine this appellate status of those claims. But to your point about the claims processing, I do believe that 20.904B can be viewed as a claims processing, and the benefit of 20.904B is the mandatory referral language, and it was that benefit that Mr. Stiles was denied by the board's failure to refer his sleep apnea and vertigo claims.
And so that your argument is that the benefit that Mr. Stiles was denied was the lack of referral?
Yes, Your Honor, the board's failure to refer, yes, ma'am.
But and that was the final decision that was being appealed, if we were to stretch the argument out to where we are now.
I think at best, Your Honor, the board failed to refer. At worst, it implicitly denied that those claims even existed.
Okay. On another note, there was a line of questioning as to Mr. Stiles. Why didn't Mr. Stiles submit a petition for extraordinary relief if this thing has been going on so long? At some point, just file a petition.
That's a great question, Your Honor. In this situation, Mr. Stiles doesn't believe that a petition for extraordinary relief was the proper mechanism because of the mandatory language of 20.904B. So Mr. Stiles engaged counsel while his claims were at the board, and counsel immediately notified the board that the record reasonably raised these sleep apnea and vertigo claims. And under the mandatory referral requirement under 20.904B, because that regulation directly addresses this factual situation and requires that the board take affirmative action, it's not an extraordinary circumstance that would warrant a writ in this situation.
They did not amount to extraordinary circumstances. Is that what you said?
Correct, Your Honor. So raising this issue to the board and triggering the board's affirmative duty to refer those claims, that's the regulation that controls the situation. So by bringing it to the board's attention and expecting the board to refer the claims, there was not a reason to write a writ and file a writ at that point.
Despite the fact that there's a processing rule, may or may not be a processing rule, but a rule that says the board has to remand certain things over, and at which point that could have been the extraordinary relief sought, the continuing processing of Mr. Stiles' claims for vertigo and apnea.
Mr. Stiles reviews the board's refusal to refer his claim as containing as the actionable event that is independently reviewable, as containing the implicit denial that 20.904B either applied or that had a duty under 20.904B. And it was that implicit denial, it was that refusal to act that would be actionable in this court. And so the normal appellate procedures would dictate that Mr. Stiles should appeal as opposed to filing a writ for an extraordinary circumstance.
Thank you, Mr. Luck.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Luck, I want to follow up on Mr. Morris's argument saying that there was no harm here. Did I understand you earlier in your argument to say that the harm to Mr. Stiles is the shifting of the board's burden to refer and to keep this these claims that had been filed but not adjudicated, to keep them moving, that the harm was the shifting of this burden onto the veteran rather than the board carrying through with its responsibility?
Yes, Your Honor. The board's failure to refer those claims violated its obligation under 20.904B. That's a benefit. The board's mandatory referral is a benefit to Mr. Stiles. And the board working in connection with the regional office to keep these claims moving, to identify and to refer these reasonably raised claims, or to take action when the reasonably raised claim was discovered, or when it was notified of the reasonably raised claims. It's that benefit that Mr. Stiles was denied, or at worst, as stated in pleadings, it implicitly determined that there was no reasonably raised claims, or you know, these claims didn't even exist. So not only was he denied the benefit of referral, but potentially could have been denied the benefits altogether.
Thank you, Mr. Luck. Judge Meredith, do you have further questions?
I just have one.
Let's add 5 minutes, Ms. Briquet. Thank you.
You've referred a few times to a referral as a benefit. What definition of benefit are you using, and how does that square with the traditional definition of benefit, meaning basically the service connection or a type of commodity that's going to flow to the veteran if he's successful on the claim?
Well, Mr. Stiles does acknowledge that there can be multiple benefits, not just a benefit in terms of a monetary recovery and a successful claim for service connection, but under 38 CFR 20.3E, a benefit means any payment, service, commodity, function, or status, entitlement to which is determined under the laws of the VA pertaining to the veteran or their dependents and survivors. So a status would be that there is a reasonably raised claim that is pending adjudication.
Whether the board says it's pending or not, does that change by the referral? Is there any legal consequence to referral versus non-referral in terms of whether that claim is still pending?
Well, there is a burden shifting if the board doesn't take action that is mandated under 20.904B.
But it doesn't change the legal status of if there was a pending claim. It's still pending.
Correct. If there is, if the board implicitly denies that these claims were not reasonably raised, or again, were previously denied, were not placed in appellate status, things like that, that would change potentially whether that status has changed. But the referral obligation itself, I don't believe changes the status, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Peach, do you have further questions?
On status, in the context of the portion that you read, wouldn't a reasonable interpretation mean that that status is referring to the status of whether the individual is a veteran or not? I mean, that status as opposed to a certain level of where that individual is in a litigation process or an administrative claims process, that it's a status as, you know, whether you're a veteran or not, or whether you're, can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the words within Section 20.3E are intended to be broad and read in the most veteran-friendly light. Status can mean a veteran's status, whether the veteran has achieved the definition and satisfied the definition of a veteran and achieved a veteran status. The fact that it is in connection with service, commodity, function, all those are really to view the regulations as a whole in terms of the application of the benefit system to the veteran. So taking status out in isolation can refer to that, can refer to a claim status. The same thing with function or service. Those, I believe, refer to the benefit system as a whole. And again, as stated earlier, there is more than one benefit in the chain in the request for a claim for service-connected disability benefits. And
Thank you. And with no further questions, we will move. Thank you, Mr. Luck. We will move on to Mr. Morris's rebuttal. Mr. Morris, you may move forward.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, the denial of a process is not an appealable matter. And that's what the appellant here is arguing, that he was denied some process of a referral, the flagging of a potential claim for the RO. That's not an appealable board decision. Your Honors, error and jurisdiction are two wholly separate matters. Error is what the court reviews if it has jurisdiction. It's the merits of the appeal, and the court can't get to the merits of an appeal without the necessary jurisdiction. And again, as the Secretary started, Your Honor, there are three things that the court has to find here. It has to find that there is an appealable board decision, because an appeal can only be initiated by a person adversely affected by a final board decision. And the appellant recognizes and admits that there has been no denial of any benefits or termination of any claim here. At best, he's suggesting that he was denied some technical benefit of an application of a statute for which he acknowledges that there exists other remedies anyway. But for purposes of a final board decision, there simply is none. And then, Your Honor, even if there is one, that this potential jurisdictional hook, the court still has to find that that jurisdiction extends over this issue of, you know, whether it can review the failure to refer, which again, Your Honors, is not even a jurisdictional determination. It's not an implicit denial of jurisdiction or of a claim. It is simply the failure to, at best, the failure to flag an issue for the RO, the failure to acknowledge a potential claim in the record, and has no bearing on the appellant's ability to prosecute that claim and continue prosecuting that claim. And again, it also has no impact whatsoever on the jurisdictional status of that claim. Not referring a claim does not change where its jurisdiction lays. To the extent that those claims exist, they are and have been and continue to be before the agency of original jurisdiction. While the appellant seems to suggest that the court has its authority to review jurisdictional determinations, that authority does not exist absolutely. And again, one, there is no jurisdictional determination, but two, that authority exists to the extent that the court needs to review jurisdiction for the sake of its own jurisdiction. But if the board didn't have jurisdiction over these claims, the court clearly does not have jurisdiction over those claims. So there's no need for the court to review it. And finally, Your Honor, the court still has to find that the appellant has that standing to raise these issues. And again, at best, he has argued that the benefit he was denied was the application of a regulatory requirement. But the failure to apply a regulatory requirement, absent a showing of concrete harm that results, is not sufficient to give rise to standing under Article 3 or the court's jurisdiction.
But wasn't Mr. Luck just arguing that the shifting of the burden from the board onto the veteran to keep the claim moving in the process, which, as we know, is a difficult thing for many pro se veterans to do, that was the injury here?
Respectfully, Your Honor, that one, that assumes something that, or it conflates two different concepts. Again, a referral is simply a referral. It flags something and it says, you're in the wrong part, you know, agency, you know, here's a potential claim. It is not an adjudicative finding with respect to that claim, nor is it an order compelling that claim, as, you know, framed by the board, be adjudicated. That is the responsibility of the RO, and that responsibility exists with or without a referral. If there is a claim before the agency, it is responsible for adjudicating that claim. So the board's referral is not what determines whether the agency has to adjudicate a claim. It is a flagging process. There's no shifting of any burden. That burden, to the extent that a claim exists, has always existed at the agency level. That is the agency's responsibility. The difference here is that the appellant is trying to get the board to refer something which, again, doesn't redress the injury there, because there is none. The referral does not demand an adjudication of anything. That is the responsibility of the agency, regardless of whether there is a referral. And to the extent that the agency is required to do that, the appellant has remedies. The allegation is that since 2008, at least one of these claims, since 2008, the first mention of any outstanding claim was made in 2019. No contact has been made with the agency itself to ask for an adjudication of the vertigo claim. We don't even know that it exists. This is all, we can assume these things for the sake of the jurisdictional questions. There's been no allegation. The ultimate point here is that this appeal, an appeal of a board decision that remanded two claims and did not erroneously refuse to take jurisdiction over a claim, did not take jurisdiction erroneously, that is not a vehicle to get this question in front of the court. The merits of the appellant's argument.
Judge Peach, did you have a question?
Yes, I did.
Let's add 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. If the board had referred those two, quote, claims, would you have objections to that? Is because the board went out of its jurisdictional realm, ultra vires, to do that?
Nothing changes. The board's referral action is not an adjudicative finding. The RO would still, the board suggests there's something potential in the record. The RO would then consider that. And the RO would define the scope of any potential claim that might have existed, not the board in the first instance. So a referral would have made no difference here. It doesn't change the obligation of the agency. It doesn't change the actual existence of what any reasonably raised claim might look like. Because again, that's the RO's job to do in the first instance. The board would simply have flagged it. So what didn't happen here is the flagging of a potential reasonably raised claim in the record. And again, that is something that is simply not a matter for discussion unless and until the court gets to a merits of a decision that somehow denied benefits for either of those claims, whether independently or whether by virtue of the failure to assign an effective date. But we don't have those issues. Appellant wants a simple, purely legal compliance with the regulation that would have made no difference whatsoever as to the existence of his claims, the agency's obligations, or any, it would not force or cause the agency to act in any different, you know, by any different timeline. Again, he gets nothing out of this, but more to the point, he doesn't even get into the courthouse to raise this argument. And even if he got into the courthouse, the court still wouldn't have jurisdiction over it because, again, the failure to refer is not a jurisdiction taking or, you know, refusing action, nor is it one that terminates any claim for benefits. And appellant himself has also failed to show that he's even suffered any actual injury as a result of the a procedural violation, as opposed to perhaps an injury caused by the agency's failure to adjudicate his claims, which is an entirely different injury, not redressable by a referral of his claim by the board.
As to that point, if in fact the RO has been failing to adjudicate a claim, the appellant's counsel made a point that the board, general counsel's office, the regional offices, it's all part of one agency. Has the general counsel's office taken any steps to notify the RO that this veteran believes he has pending unadjudicated claims?
Your Honors, I have not. But, Your Honors, this entire question is now caught up in this litigation before the court. You know, had the board decision not been appealed and the board decision been remanded, then perhaps, you know, at this, given that these arguments were raised again in 2019, something may have happened. It also may not have, in which case, again, the agency might be at fault if there are claims that it didn't address. It might not be if there actually are no claims. Because again, the RO has to make that determination, but no determinations have been made whatsoever. This is premature, you know, this litigation, and misplaced. This is not the time or place for these arguments. And the remedy that's being sought is not one that cures any injury connected to, you know, a board's denial or termination or, you know, failure to grant in full a claim for benefits. The appellant wants the board to have added language, non-binding, non-adjudicatory language to a decision to get some, you know, to highlight to the RO something that was already sitting and potentially sitting in front of the RO. Your Honor, on that basis, again, we don't get through the courthouse door. We don't get to that question. And the appellant hasn't shown what difference it even would have made, let alone the concrete harm that resulted from the failure to flag an issue over which the board didn't have jurisdiction and could not have adjudicated.
And Judge Meredith, do you have any further questions?
I don't.
I have no further questions.
Okay. No further questions. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Morris. And thank you, Mr. Luck. And we thank all counsel for their arguments. The case is submitted for consideration.
The court is in recess.